Thank you, Carol. Thank you, David. It's such a privilege to be here in the New School in New York City to join you at a very interesting symposium. Carol is absolutely right. Judging from my background, I'm absolutely no expert in planning matters or even in heritage matters, so I come to learn. In fact, in the last 6 months, having settled in the job as the first secretary for development in the Hong Kong government structure, I do go out quite often to learn. In the last 6 months, I've been to London, although that's a place where I've worked for 18 months. I just came back from a visit to Melbourne and Sydney, and now I'm in New York. In fact, when I met Carol Willis about 3-4 months ago, when she was intensely preparing for this very significant exhibition, I never imagined I could actually take part in this symposium, because it takes place right after my chief executive's annual occasion of delivering his policy address, which he did 2 days ago. But maybe, fortunately, because of the financial tsunami, his mind is entirely focusing on the financial side. He said, you can go away for a couple of days if you want. So I'm here. So I arrived yesterday and already find myself very much at home, which is a very different feeling from whenever I was in London or recently in Melbourne and Sydney, because I suppose of one word, density, and these high-rises which both the cities of Hong Kong and New York City share. So I try to give you a brief account of how we have reached the present stage of being a high-rise city, and also, more importantly, to share with you some of the challenges. I'm sure you know that we have a very strong group from Hong Kong joining this symposium. They are both my friends and my pressure points. They keep me going and working in the right direction, and I'm very pleased that we are all here in New York City to talk about a subject which is very, very close to our heart. So let's watch a 50-second video just to show you this Hong Kong facelift over the last century. David means whenever people talk about density, you refer to Hong Kong. We are made famous by this waterfront scenery with all these high-rises buildings in Hong Kong. Let's take a look at the planning context of Hong Kong, starting with some very basic facts. We have a land area of just over 1,100 square kilometers and a current population of slightly below 7 million. But because of our topography, not much of the land is readily developable or inhabitable. So in terms of overall density, we are not that worse. I look at this comparative table in a skyscraper museums, and we only have 6,410 persons per square kilometers, because we do have 1,010 square kilometers in terms of size. But they are only concentrated in some of the urbanized areas in Hong Kong. So take one of the districts which is on the eastern part of the Kowloon Peninsula called the Kwun Tong. There, the density can go up to over 50,000 persons per square kilometers. In terms of housing, we are almost as a society living in very high-rise buildings in Hong Kong, either in the public sector or in the private sector. Public housing now accounts for half of the needs of Hong Kong's population. And within the public housing sector, about 2 million people live in public rental housing, whereas the remainder 1.5 million people have bought their own homes, although these houses were also built by the government through a housing authority at a highly subsidized rate. In the private housing, we could afford a little bit more diversity. So you can see in this slide, we do have high-rises apartment, or what's called condominium here. And we also have the privilege of having some detached townhouses in the more rural parts of Hong Kong or on the peak. In terms of land use, I described to you about the comparative densities. And in terms of land use, not many people realize, but for those who have spent a good bit of time in Hong Kong, you will agree and appreciate that, in fact, we are a very green city. Over 60% of Hong Kong's land, those 1,100 square kilometers I referred to, are really woodland, grassland, and wetland. And of these, in total, 44% of Hong Kong's land are actually designated as country parks or special interest areas, where absolutely no development is permitted because they are by law designated as country parks. And this numbers will go up further because the chief executive has just announced that we will declare another country park on the northern part of Lantau, which is very close to our new airport. In terms of build-up areas, it accounts for only 24%. So it's slightly less than one quarter of our land is developed. The evolution of Hong Kong into the sort of compact city and high-rise city that we are now living in has, of course, a long history. As you know, Hong Kong was first established as a British colony in 1842. And in those days, in the early settlements, we are, in a way, very colonial and very British. Of course, much would, depends on the population growth over the years that dictates Hong Kong's housing development. So the early settlements took part in two main styles. We have a Western style, and we have a more Eastern style, and that is what makes Hong Kong unique. There's often reference to the East meeting the West. And the houses that we have is very often also constrained or characterized by the lot size. So if we go back a bit, in the Western style, the lot size is normally bigger. And so we have all these detached houses with their little nice gardens and so on. Whereas in the Chinese style of the early settlements, the lot size is usually very small. It's about 30 square kilometers per lot, which is how land is being sold or transacted in those days. So the buildings tend to be very close together in the Chinese community. And over the years, housing development, of course, was intended to meet the populations of Hong Kong. As you can see, we have gone through very rapid population growth since after the Second World War, with almost 1 million additional population every decade. So between 1950 up to the end of the last century, we are always under this pressure to build in order to accommodate the additional population that Hong Kong had. But into the 21st century, this major growth in population has somehow subsided. In fact, this is also a very important planning context, which enables us really to focus on other things which in the past, to us, is a luxury. It's quite a luxury for us in the past to talk about space, to talk about more quality, to talk about, for example, environmental awareness and green buildings and so on. But I'm quite optimistic that as we now proceed, we should have more flexibility and more room for dealing with those important matters that concern members of the public. And by the way, one of the reasons why our population growth has subsided is because Hong Kong now has the world's lowest birth rate. Whenever I talk about this, people thought that because of the one-child policy applicable to Hong Kong, That's not true, because Hong Kong operates one country, two systems. So we are not required to follow this one child policy in China. Quite on the opposite, my chief executive has been advocating more children in Hong Kong. On one occasion, he was asking newly married couples each to have at least three children. The lowest birth rate we had on record is now 0.92 per childbearing woman in Hong Kong. So not enough even to replace the natural wastage. So this is a big problem that we are facing, because that means a rapid aging of Hong Kong's population. At the moment, 12% of Hong Kong's population age 65 and above. By the year 2030, we're talking about 1 in 4 of Hong Kong's population will be, and I hope by that time we don't call them elders, but 1 in 4 by that time will be aged over 65. I have mentioned in one of the basic fact slides that because of our topography, not all the land could be developed. This is, in fact, one of the main constraints. So our 1,100 square kilometers perhaps could not be compared with the New York City, but because of our hilly topography. So in those days, the easiest way to create land for development was through reclamation. I still remember when I was a kid studying in primary school, one of the first chapters in the subjects about social sciences was to talk about how successful Hong Kong was in leveling the mountain and reclaiming from the harbor. In Chinese, there are four characters that very vividly described this behavior, that is Yishan Tianhai, this is in Putonghua. So we are very proud, we are really very proud in those days of able to move the mountain and also to reclaim from the harbor. So in this slide, I'm showing you the original coastline dating back to 1887, and the current coastline, which is the blue line. And over these years, 28 square kilometers of land have been readily reclaimed from the harbor. Because I suppose it's a ready solution, because reclamation did not involve resuming land from private owners. The harbor was unlikely to argue with you whether it was right or not to reclaim from the harbor. And as you can see, through this harbor reclamation, we created the runway, which served as Hong Kong's first airport until 1998. We actually created through reclamation also the Newark Airport, although this could not be seen here because it's on the Lantau Island outside the boundary of the so-called Victoria Harbour. But the new airport was also created through massive reclamation. We also, through reclamation, met the needs of the container terminal ports, which is in the Cheng Li Island, and also a lot of development needs in a central business district and also for our growing population. Now, of course, the emergence of the a vertical city was very much dictated by the population needs, and it was supplemented or facilitated by changes in Hong Kong's buildings ordinance. So in 1935, when the buildings ordinance was first crafted to control buildings in Hong Kong, the plot ratio was very low and the height control was very rigid. No building should exceed 5 stories. So these are the type of pre-war buildings that is seen in Hong Kong. And recently, many of these remaining pre-war buildings or pre-war shop houses was the subject of conservation in Hong Kong, just to preserve this pre-war shop houses and also to reflect the way of living in those days. Then, because of a population ratio, the population pressures, the buildings ordinance was amended after the Second World War in the 1950s to allow for much higher development of a plot ratio of up to 20. So these are the buildings that were created under that sort of population pressure and building pressure in order to house adequately the people that we have seen in Hong Kong, and in fact much was driven by immigrants from the mainland of China. And in those days, we also promulgated development density zoning. But recently, when I dug from the files and looked at this, I told myself how much things have changed. Because in the past, in those days, we're talking about the 1960s and 1970s, the tendency was to put higher density and taller buildings by the waterfront. Whereas nowadays, as a result of the aspirations for protecting the Victoria Harbour, the Town Planning Board, which is very much like the Planning Commission here, has promulgated planning guidelines for the harbour front, and they require much lower buildings along the waterfront and what they call the step height. So you could have slightly higher buildings inland, but as it moves on to the waterfront, it has to be of a lower height. But in those days, about 20, 30 years ago, the low rise were preserved for the middle, for the mid-levels, for the peak, whereas the high rises and the more dense developments were often found in along the waterfront. I suppose this is only pragmatic, because in those days, the harbor was a very functional harbor. We have fishing vessels, you have port cargo being brought in by ships, and you also have refuse transfer stations along the waterfront of rubbish being transferred to landfills through the harbour. So this is this was then the situation where we have development zones ranging from a low density of a zoning of a plot ratio of 3 to a higher density of up to 8, 9, 10 on Hong Kong Island, but already much lower than the ones that you have seen immediately after the Second World War, which could go up to a plot ratio of 18, 19, 20. In 1966, the building ordinance went through another round of changes, and up till now, these standards are still applicable. For domestic buildings, normally we're talking about 8, 9, 10. Much depends on the frontage, whether the site is bounded by one street, two streets, or three streets. Then you have different plot ratios for domestic buildings. But for commercial buildings, we are more liberal. We allow the plot ratio of 15. So most of the iconic buildings that you have just seen from the short video, they are the products of this higher plot ratio for non-domestic buildings in order to meet Hong Kong's development needs as we progress into a financial center and a service center in Asia. As I mentioned, most of those standards are still applicable today, although they have been turned into more sophisticated guidelines for compliance by developers. At the same time, we are also moving into new town, because there's no way that we could accommodate all the people that we had through just developments around the harbourfront on both sides of Victoria Harbour. So in new town development, we're also going for high density, although not as high as we have seen in some of the urbanized areas. Over the years, through investment in infrastructure, particularly in transport infrastructure, we have been very successful in developing several generations of new towns, first starting with new towns like Tsuen Wan and Kwai Chung, which serves all of Hong Kong's industrial needs in the 1950s, and then moving into new towns like Sha Tin, Tai Po, and the latest generation of Cheung Kwan Lo and Tin Tui Wai. What we did not manage to do successfully, which I heard Amanda telling me, was Mayor Bloomberg's priority, is to make sure that all these new towns are self-sustainable in a sense that they are both residential, commercial, and so on. Up till now, I have to say that most of our new towns do not manage to really create all the jobs needed for the people living there. So there's still a lot of commuting to be done by people living in the new towns. But fortunately, we do have a very efficient public infrastructure. Similarly, as our economy evolves from one which is manufacturing to one which is service, that means in the old areas of development, there's a lot of scope for redevelopment. So over the last two, three decades, we have seen major evolutions, perhaps also facilitated by, again, what Amanda told me about zoning, upzoning, downzoning, So the Taikoo Dockyards, which is on the Hong Kong, eastern part of Hong Kong Island, has been turned into a major residential district called the Taikoo Shing, housing almost 25,000 people in one estate, one development. Similarly, on the Kowloon side, Kowloon Peninsula, the Whampoa Dockyard has also been changed into a Whampoa Garden, another major residential project with over 9,000 units for housing needs. Power stations turn into South Horizon estate developments. Now, so our development is basically in the urbanized areas and also reaching up to the new times. So this chart shows you the evolution over the years. Back in 1971, only 10%, of course, if you look back another 10 years before we started new towns, all the people were living in the urbanized urban areas. Since 1971, when we built the first generation of new towns, they housed about 10% of Hong Kong's population. Up till now, almost half of Hong Kong's population are living in the new towns that I have just described to you. So they pose a lot of needs on Hong Kong's infrastructure, and also particularly on transport. So responding to the physical constraints and the demand for land, the first thing that we have done, and I think much credit goes to this, is the development of Hong Kong's rail network, the mass transit railway. And of course, I believe Thomas Hull from the Mass Transit Railway Corporation Limited has spoken to you about how successful rail has managed to make Hong Kong move in the last two decades. At the moment, the total length of rail in Hong Kong is about 212 kilometers. Those are shaded in black. And in time to come, it will grow very significantly to over 300 kilometers. And in fact, where it is shaded red here, except the northern link, there's a short strip with an arrow up there, the northern link, all the other new rail lines have been confirmed that they are no longer just on the drawing board. They will be built. Each and every one of these new rail lines has a completion date, as announced by the chief executive in his policy address last year under what he called the 10 major infrastructure. And one of the interesting thing about building this new generation of railways is it is no longer just for domestic needs, that is commuting within Hong Kong. It also strengthens cross-boundary relationship between Hong Kong and the mainland. So for example, we are building this major railway, the one that goes right up from the Kowloon side to Shenzhen. In fact, it will end in Guangzhou. This is an express rail train where there will be no stop within Hong Kong. So it's one stop from Hong Kong to Shenzhen and then all the way to Guangzhou, because it is now part of our important strategy is to enhance development and communication between Hong Kong and the hinterland and the mainland. That will provide the growth, the impetus for economic growth in Hong Kong. We do have a very, very efficient public transport system. These are indicated in these two graphs. First of all, in terms of road, public road built per capita, we are very, very low. It's 0.29 as compared to the United States of America. In terms of private car ownership, despite the affluence in Hong Kong, we have a very sound per capita GDP, but our private car ownership is very low. It's only 53 per 1,000 population. And this is made possible because of very efficient public transport system. This is also made possible because of other fiscal measures like fuel tax, first registration tax, and the availability of parking spaces and so on. So at the moment, public transport accounts for 89% of the average daily trips. And I think the mass transit railway, i.e. the rails are ticking, what, 37%, almost, right? 37% of average daily trips are commuted in Hong Kong do so on the railway. So, of course, without the public transport, Hong Kong will be clogged up because there are simply not enough roads to take the cars to drive people around to work or to leisure. I don't know whether Thomas has taken through you this is a very successful rail plus property model, which is of course one of the reasons why we have ended up with the high density development that we have seen today. It is really very is miraculous that all these railway projects were built without incurring a single dollar of the government's money. What the government does is through promoting or advocating this rail plus property model, that is by giving the property development rights on top of the railway stations or the depots to the Mass Transit Railway Company so that they could generate needed proceeds and profits to invest in the railway development. But of course, by definition, railway stations are very rectangular in shape. So in a way, they has given rise to some of the problems that I'm going to share with you and which Thomas and I have to tackle with this high density wall effect on some of the major railway property development projects. But here there are two important projects. One is of course the Kowloon Station, where we now have major high rises, in fact, building the tallest building in Hong Kong. And the other is the Zhuang Huan Lo New Town, where through this rail plus property model, the railway company has been given, 33 hectares of land to build in phases what they call this Dream City. But now they have adopted a new name called the Lohas Park. And Lohas stands for what? Living of, H stands for healthy and sustainability, okay. I thought it was borrowed from a movie, but later on I realized it was only an acronym for a lot of good things, that is health and sustainability. So this model works extremely well in the past, but we are going to make slight changes to it. Because it works in the past because the railway is entering new areas, virgin sites. So there's a lot of development potential for above rail station properties. But some of the latest railways that we are going to build together with the railway company, they are no longer in really the greenfield sites. For example, we are building one, what we call the Southern Island Line, that will take commuters all the way from Admiralty Station to Ocean Park in less than 5 minutes and so on. And there's very little potential or remaining land that we could give to Mass Transit Railway Company for building property. And of course, there's also another problem is we have to strike a balance between the land sale program and also this railway development program. But nevertheless, I think Hong Kong takes pride in having invested and developed a very efficient railway network through this particular model. But whether it can be applied elsewhere is a big question mark. For example, I was in a few cities in mainland in the last couple of months, and they were also talking about a lot of railway development, but they have a lot of reservations on doing this rail plus rail property model. And of course, beyond the railway model, we also try to meet the housing needs and the balanced development through promoting what we call mixed development. So a typical development in a mixed development zone is a commercial stroke residential zone. So there it could be a good mix of shops, retails, and flats, and car parks, and government facilities in one development on a particular site. And if we want to do it even better, in a more integrated way, then through zoning, we could zone or rezone areas as what we call the CDAs, Comprehensive Development Area Zones. It would typically promulgate land uses in terms of housing, in terms of hotels, offices, and so on. But the important thing about a CDA zone is anybody who wants to develop in a CDA zone has to submit a MLP, a Master Layout Plan, for the Town Planning Board to approve. So the Plum Planet Board retains this inference or authority over the actual planning and design of the CDA's sites. But because of the scattered ownership that I have shared with Amanda earlier in the afternoon, it is actually very difficult to implement comprehensive development area zones because the ownership is in the hands of hundreds, if not thousands, of small owners. So assembling the needed land to do a comprehensive and integrated development is extremely difficult. In Hong Kong, of the 108 OZP, statutory outline zoning plans, we have designated over 100, I think the exact number is 105 CDA zones. But up till now, we managed only to develop 10. So a lot of good things appear, they are still only in theory appearing in our plans. They are not actually capable of being early implementation because of the ownership issue. Another factor that has contributed to the success of the vertical city of density is, of course, this very convenient pedestrian linkages through footbridges linking office buildings, through also government-built escalators that go uphill, and also through other walkways and railway stations. Many of these were achieved through land lease specifications. In other words, when we sell a piece of land for commercial development, we will make it a requirement that you need to connect up with the new building or an existing building across the street. Or even when the across the street building has yet to pop up, then you have to reserve the connecting points so that when that opposite site is sold, there will still be this potential of connection. In his policy address delivered 2 days ago, the chief executive has laid a lot of emphasis on increasing and improving Hong Kong's pedestrianization because it contributes not only to better linkage, it also contributes to our fight against air pollution, trying to discourage driving into the more congested areas in Hong Kong. So he has asked us to do two things. First is to examine the potential for more uphill escalators, that is, hillside escalators. And also, secondly, to put in more pedestrian areas, either through subways or through footbridges. So over the last 150 years, Hong Kong has transformed gradually into the vertical city, a very compact vertical city that we are now in. And the benefits of high-density living, in a nutshell, first is it provides a very economical use of land, because first of all, it was driven by the shortage of developable land in Hong Kong that we have gone for high density development. And secondly, it also enables us to invest in infrastructure because you need to have that sort of patronage in order to build your railways and so on. And so with that sort of high density development, it is able for us to invest in the infrastructure. And of course, another benefit is in integrated development. You just imagine that the place you live is supported by a lot of other facilities in terms of shopping, retail, restaurants, movies, cinemas, and also all the necessary GIC, what we call GICs, government, institutional, and community facilities, all on the same footprint. So very often you just don't have to go out and in order to meet your daily needs. But I would say that the biggest benefit of high-density development in a unique situation like Hong Kong is to enable us to conserve for the enjoyment of not only the present, but also the future generations, our countryside. I've mentioned to you that 66% of our land is actually reserved for countryside, for leisure, for public enjoyment, through destination as country parks, marine parks, wetlands, and so on. So next time when you are in Hong Kong, please remember to visit our countryside so that you don't leave Hong Kong with the impression that we are just a high-rise, congested city. We are also a very livable and a very green city. But there are issues. I think there's always the other side of the coin. To have high-rise vertical development, like many cities, we confront a number of issues. First is this building height and building bulk contention. The Kowloon Station is the one that I have just shown you, in which development is still going on. The one being built under construction is going to be the tallest building, the International Commercial Center, which will then overtake the International Financial Center on the other side of the harbor. In fact, they are built by the same developer together with the Mass Transit Railway Corporation. So I would readily admit why the Hong Kong community, the Hong Kong public, has this concern, if not grievances about building heights, because this is what they have seen in the recent decade. Along the waterfront, all these high-rise buildings popped up, bridging the ridge lines, and also, more importantly, is causing the problems, the visual problem and environmental problems. So it is now very common in Hong Kong to find, you know, these tall residential towers sitting on podiums and so on. This is the ridgeline protection, which we have done a little study, because perhaps unlike New York, Hong Kong is very hilly. So on both sides of the harbour, we do have very nice peaks, Lion Rock, Kowloon Peak. But by the creation of these high rises, the bridge lines have been bridged. So people feel that this is perhaps not the right sort of planning that we should continue to allow, particularly in very advantaged areas. It also brings along some environmental problems where we place our high rises next to major highways, generating traffic noise. And also this new phenomenon of light pollution, where high-rise buildings are lit up for decoration and for other purposes in the evening. And also this interface issue, when through rezoning, we are able to rezone previously industrial areas for commercial or residential development. But because of the problems of scattered land titles and ownership, we're not able to resolve this interface issue. So there are still occasions where factory buildings, whether they are in active use or not in active use, sitting side by side with residential buildings, again causing problems of noise and air pollution and so on. We also have what we call social problems. By the latest design, where they are sitting on podiums, because everybody is chasing for height, so they stack up the buildings by having commercial premises, retail, shopping malls, car parks, and clubs facilities on a podium, and then towers of high rises. So some sociologists start to write and comment on we seems to be creating a sense of alienation in Hong Kong society. There's no street light whatsoever, that people don't have a chance to interact. They just go back to the high-rise buildings. And so particularly in some of the new towns where there's a lot of public rental housing built in that fashion, we now have a bit of social problems that we need to tackle. Now, this is again a new term coined in Hong Kong's planning context, the wall effect that we built. We built high rises, but we built high rises packed together, so they form a wall. Which sometimes is not bad to look at, but you imagine for the inner areas living in low-rise, or not low-rise, but medium-rise buildings, all being blocked by these walls in front of them. So complaining about air ventilation, about visual, about all sorts of problems. So this is an example of a project that together with Mass Transit Railway, in fact, with the help of Thomas, that my bureau is re-examining whether we should really build like this fashion. This is on top of a railway station which has already been built and brought into operation. But the new flats here are still under planning, so we still have a chance to change this sort of scheme. This was the original scheme, which will comprise 12 high-rise on one podium of the Nam Chom station. We are under a lot of pressure, and the chief executive has allowed us to revisit the scheme, which of course means housing units being reduced, which also means public revenue being forgone if we are going to build less on this particular site. But I personally feel that it is worthwhile in order to strike a better balance between driving for high density development on the one hand and assuring quality living on the other for people of Hong Kong. Scientists also have their complaint, complaining about this heat island effect, where temperature goes up in certain urbanized areas because all the heat is being trapped because of the high rises aligning both sides of the streets. So they have also done and published studies at Hong Kong Polytechnic University, warning us that we better do something about it. Otherwise, we are being a big contributor to this climate change by creating all this heat island effect. There is another range of issues that have, of course, put our planning issue in a greater context, and this is a concern about the harbour protection. And whenever I talk about harbour reclamation or harbour protection, I must pay tribute to a lady who is in the audience tonight, Christine Lo. When Christine was a member of the Hong Kong Legislative Council, that is sort of parliament, she almost single-handedly pushed through a private member's bill to protect Hong Kong's Victoria Harbour. So under the Protection of Harbour Ordinance, there is a presumption against harbour reclamation, i.e. the Victoria Harbour. In other words, we should not, as government, reclaim from the harbour. This piece of ordinance was put to test in a court back in 2004, and I was fortunate enough to be fighting the legal battles on behalf of government in those days. But I think we actually benefit from the piece of legal advice coming all the way from the highest court, the Court of Final Appeal, which gives us better definition of how we operate this presumption against harbour reclamation. And that is, if we want to do any more reclamation in Victoria Harbour, it has to meet the overriding public need test. And in fact, this test is very difficult to meet, which means that we should perhaps give up altogether on harbour reclamation. So as a result of that series of legal battles, the government has made a public pledge that after completing a final piece of reclamation for the purpose of a major trunk road linking the eastern parts of Hong Kong Island to central, then we will do no more reclamation in the Victoria Harbour and focus our efforts on enhancing the harbourfront for the enjoyment of the public. I mentioned about the chief executive's policy address this year. I only had one contribution to his policy address this year, and that is a harbour. There was an occasion when I spoke to the chief executive who was doing his final term, because the chief executive, like the mayor here, could only do two terms. And my chief executive has absolutely no intention to amend the basic law to allow him to do a third term. He said he has enough. And so I asked him whether he wants to leave behind any legacy after all this work in the public sector. And if he did, then I suggested that perhaps Victoria Harbour is something that he wants to leave behind for the benefit of future generations. So I managed to tuck in a little paragraph for him to express his sentiments about Victoria Harbour. And with that comes, of course, the mandate for me as the Secretary for Development to be able to command a little bit more respect amongst my colleagues who want to do all sorts of silly things with the harbour front and so on. So all these is, in my view, I really sincerely make this statement whenever I talk about the harbour, that we have to express our appreciation to what the civil society has done to really remind the government that the time has come for us not to take more from the harbour. You have seen from the slides how much we have taken from the Victoria Harbour, and it's really time to return the harbour to the people of Hong Kong. Another major concern that has popped up over the last few years is, of course, heritage preservation, which now also comes under my portfolio. In the past, heritage was treated as part of culture. So heritage preservation was put in terms of government administration under the Ministry of Culture, or in our Hong Kong context, the Bureau for Home Affairs. In this term of the government, I mentioned, if you remember, I'm the first Secretary for Development. So a Development Bureau is created in this term of the government. And the Chief Executive has very cleverly put infrastructure, development, and heritage conservation under one roof. So I now have the difficult task of trying to balance development, economic progress on the one hand, preservation on Hong Kong's history and heritage on the other. So hopefully that we could be able to do the balancing act better and to be able to preserve Hong Kong's heritage. I wouldn't bother you with a lot of things that we are doing on the heritage preservation, but having listened to Bob Tierney earlier this afternoon, I realized that we still have a lot more to do in order to really make any headway or successes in preserving Hong Kong's heritage. Heritage preservation goes beyond just preserving historic buildings or historic sites. It also means preserving the way of living, that people have a particular memory. It also means preserving areas with local characteristics and culture. So I also have this task of doing this, which means preserving Hong Kong's open-air markets, wet markets, and so on. And since I took over this job, whenever I read from a touristy book for foreign visitors, I realized that actually the things that have attracted tourists more in Hong Kong are the bustling street markets. It was always amongst the first five things that people want to do and see in Hong Kong, our very busy street markets. So this is really something that worth reminding us that we should not just remove all these hawkers from the streets because they are a major contributor to Hong Kong's local characteristics. Another concern is even in more abstract or intangible terms, is social network. People are now not only concerned about losing heritage buildings, losing memories of how they used to live. But they are also very concerned about losing neighborhoods, losing social networks that they have built up through years of living together. So on the one hand, while we go in to do urban regeneration or urban redevelopment, we have to do it with a lot of sensitivity these days, trying to preserve as much as possible the social networks, particularly of old people living together and interacting with each other. This is the scene when last year we did a major redevelopment in one of the streets called the Wedding Card Street on the Hong Kong Island. There's a lot of protests against the Urban Renewal Authority going in and compensating, removing the people, acquiring the properties, and then putting in new buildings instead. All these concerns, unfortunately, were reflected in a major project that we want to do last year or earlier this year. This is a major preservation and revitalization project. The buildings are called the Central Police Station Kampa. This is a very precious cluster of remaining heritage buildings in Hong Kong, a total of 17 buildings comprising police stations, magistracies, and prisons. They are all declared monuments, subject to very stringent control, absolutely no demolition. Last year, we had an understanding with the Hong Kong Jockey Club, which is the biggest charity organization in Hong Kong, to do a revitalization of this compound. But because of the constraints and the historic buildings, we just don't have enough space to put in the things that we want to, like an auditorium of this size, like some exhibition galleries and so on. So the club commissioned Herzog and de Meuron to come to do a piece in Hong Kong. And the Swiss architects have proposed this new structure, the one that you see, He was inspired by Hong Kong's bamboo scaffolding to come up with this structure. But fortunately, the Central Police Station compound sits in an area which is very built up already with very narrow streets. So people dislike the Herzog design. I don't know whether it's for the first time that Herzog's design will be disliked. So now we are putting it back to the drawing board to recreate a new structure which will be more compatible with the historic buildings and more acceptable to the people. To me, I've said in public that this is a pity because Hong Kong is lacking in some of the more contemporary landmark infrastructure or architecture that would make a city great. But never mind, I'm still very optimistic that in 6 months' time, Herzog will come up with a revised conceptual design that will achieve the original objective of preserving and revitalizing this very important cluster of buildings in Hong Kong. Now finally, just to outline to you meeting the challenges. It is not an easy task with all these conflicting demands that put on us as society, especially when we are still destined to grow to meet Hong Kong's economic needs. So what we have done as a first step is to have a very high level commitment to sustainable development in Hong Kong. And this commitment, of course, comes from the chief executive. He has introduced a new term to guide our future development in Hong Kong, and what he called progressive development. In other words, while we strive for economic progress, at the same time, we should pay a lot more attention to the environmental needs, to social, to cultural requirements. Hopefully, the end product will be something that is more sustainable and more welcome by the community at large. He also expects us to do far more public participation in planning process, and I'll show you a couple of examples later on. And nowadays, it is a mandatory requirement for all the major programs or major projects to go through what we call the sustainability assessment requirements. I mentioned about the lesser growth in population, which gives us the room and the flexibility to plan and build on a more quality basis. So looking ahead up to 2030, we are expecting a population of no more than about 8 million. In fact, I'm not too sure that we could reach that level down the road. But because of this lesser growth in population demands, then we are planning a new generation of new development areas. They will be smaller in size. All the new towns that I have shown you are huge. They house 500,000 each. But these are the new development areas which will be smaller in size, about 0.3 million or 0.35 million population each. And they are also planned along the railway infrastructure. So these are two of the new development areas which we are planning in the northern part of the new territories. So we have a long lead time to plan because we don't have this building pressure yet. So the first population intake is expected to be 10 years down the road. But we have already started the detailed planning study and through a lot of public engagement, town hall meetings, to ask people what do they want to have in this new town or new development areas. A second thing we are doing to meet the challenge is also to revisit the O-line zoning plans that I just mentioned to you. These are the statutory plans that govern Hong Kong's development. So we have already promulgated about a dozen new plans, which will put in more stringent development control parameters in terms of the size, in terms of the height, and so on. But every time we do this, it's very, very controversial. We have the developers on one hand arguing about relaxation, and then we have the activists and the community groups, on the other hand, arguing for even lower heights and lower density. So my job in between is to try to find the pragmatic balance that could at least address the main concerns of both sides. We have also developed, through the Town Planning Board, various design principles. But I have a very interesting session with Alex in Amanda's department, and this is one major area that I realize we have to do far more in promulgating urban design and promoting urban design. But these are some of the guidelines that we have put out to achieve what I call more people-oriented design. I mentioned about enhanced public engagement in planning. As you know, we moved the airport from Kai Tak in an urban Kowloon to the Lantau Island since 1998. But in the last 10 years, the same piece of land vacated by the old airport is still lying idle. That's because we are doing planning. Keep on doing planning. We have a very intensive process of public engagement for 26 months with over 70 town hall meetings, public forums, and design competitions, and so on. And I'm pleased to say that we managed to finalize the outline zoning plan for the Kai Tak development last year. We managed to do this with the least of confrontation and resistance from people. Now we are moving into the implementation gear. One of the things we want to do is to develop an international cruise terminal using the runway, because we are not reclaiming, so the runway will continue to be a runway in terms of configuration, which provides a site for developing a cruise terminal. And of course, one of the reasons that enable us to engage the public more proactively and positively in a Kai Tak development is an extensive reduction in density. Kai Tak was originally planned to be a population size of 280,000 people, but now it's down to 88,000. So with that reduction in density, we are able to do more spacious planning, more green, more parks in this new development area. The second important area that we are engaging the public is, of course, the Central Harbour Front. This is the final piece of reclamation that I just referred to. After completing the reclamation by the end of next year, we will have created a unique opportunity in Hong Kong, which is in the central business district. We have this reclaimed land, which enable us to deliver to the people of Hong Kong a vibrant and accessible harbourfront, which people could enjoy. So we have done two rounds of public engagement. I realize that the subject is still very contentious. There's still different sorts of views on how to plan a central harbourfront, and we are there to listen. Because these days, planning together with the people is a very important guideline in the job that I'm doing. We're also doing on conserving Hong Kong's heritage through some of the big projects I have mentioned, but also, more importantly, is to put in what we call the heritage impact assessment, so that in future, the public sector wants to do any project, whether it's building a road, a rail line, developing an area, we have to be very careful in order to reduce or minimize the impact on Hong Kong's historic past. And one thing that I learned, whether from the English heritage or from the Australia heritage or from the Landmark Preservation Commission here, is you don't have to talk about compensation. You just go in and list the buildings for preservation. But in Hong Kong, I'm afraid we don't have that luxury. Because land is so valuable in Hong Kong, and because we have absolute respect for private property. So what we have to do is to look for economic incentives in order to promote preservation of historic buildings which are privately owned. And one recent example that we have done is to do a land swap, a land exchange with a private owner who in turn will give up a 1930 mansion, a historic mansion, plus the site in return for the government giving them a site next door. That's shown in the picture over there. The site is exactly the same size of the same development parameters, though there will be a land exchange to enable us to preserve the historic mansion. But the room for doing this sort of thing is very limited in Hong Kong because we are such a built-up area. We're also requiring air ventilation assessment. where private sector or public sector projects are of a certain size. For example, the rail projects I'm working with the Mass Transit Railway. The railway company has been asked to do air ventilation assessments so that we can have more scientific basis in order to design or decide how the building should be configured and so on. Then on a site-specific or area-based specific basis, we have introduced these design guidelines in order to create the needed breezeways, the pathways, the visual corridors and greening and so on. All these guidelines will be applied when private developers come forward for planning permissions, for developing the comprehensive development areas, then we will require compliance with these urban design guidelines. But of course, it's not always easy because sometimes a developer could be developing on a site which is not subject to any more planning control. And also there's no restrictions whatsoever in the land lease, then we have no leverage, so to speak, to impose these requirements on the private developments. Visual impact assessment is again something that we have introduced in order to ensure that when the town planning board approves planning applications, they know exactly what are the implications. Green building is something that the chief executive attaches a lot of importance to. So in his policy address, he have required that we would mandate the efficiency, energy efficiency codes in new buildings. And we also will be providing subsidies and grants for owners of existing buildings to retrofit the buildings to make them greener and also to be more energy efficient. Because in Hong Kong, the built environment accounts for 89% of the energy consumed in Hong Kong. So planning for the next generation. I mentioned about the study 2030, which sets the strategic directions for Hong Kong's planning into 2030. There are three broad directions. First is, understandably, to continue to enhance Hong Kong's economic competitiveness, which means that we would need to continue to develop and also to build, to supply grade 8 offices to meet the needs of the financial center and so on. But the second broad direction is also to provide a quality living environment through the many things that my bureau and also the Environment Bureau and hopefully the Transport Bureau are also contributing to. And thirdly is to strengthen the links with the mainland. So some of the cross-boundary infrastructure that I've talked about will be contributing to this strengthened links, which will enable to provide the impetus for Hong Kong's economic growth. But nothing is more important than leadership and a mandate from above. So I'm sharing with you three quotations from the CE's policy address last year and this year. The first quotation is, I just described to you, this progressive development concept, where the CE said that apart from economic benefits, we should strive for benefits to culture, the society, and the environment. The second quotation is the importance of heritage, where the CE said that cultural life is a key component of a quality city life. So a progressive city cherishes its own culture and history, along with a living experience unique to the city. So in recent years, of course, he referred to some of those social movements that we have seen and confrontations that we have experienced. Hong Kong people have expressed passion for our culture and for our lifestyle. So in the next 5 years in his term, he will press ahead with the work on heritage conservation. This also came out in his last policy address. In his latest policy address, this is a short paragraph that I managed to put into his policy address on harbour. Imbued with a cultural and historical significance, Victoria Harbour is an icon of our city. All Hong Kong people cherish it as our precious asset. The Development Bureau, i.e. my bureau, will coordinate the work of different government departments to ensure the effective implementation of projects to beautify and revitalize these areas. I hope that our beautiful harbour will remain a symbol of our city that can be enjoyed by all. If you ask me, I would very much like to replace the verb coordinate by steering or mandating. But I learned from Amanda this very important message that as public officials, we should work by persuasion. So I would try my charm and persuasive powers to ensure that we could deliver all these very important initiatives of the chief executive. I thank you for your patience to listen to me. As I said, I'm no expert. I'm still learning in this very important job. And I do thank New York City for giving me a lot of inspirations in less than 24 hours' time since my arrival. Thank you very much.